Shame dies when stories are told in safe places. My name is Andrea, and this is Adult Child. Welcome back to Adult Child, where we take a deep dive into the impact of growing up in a dysfunctional family. Ahoy, my dear shit shows. For any new listeners, my name is Andrea. I'm a total and complete shit show. I literally just walked in the door of my apartment after spending a week in Canada with a fellow member of the shit show, Carrie. You know, I was saying to her one night at dinner, when I was sitting on the floor of my closet next to my cat's litter box creating this podcast, never did I envision that, you know, in several years later that I'd be visiting one of my listener and fellow shit show members' houses in Quebec. You never know where life is going to take you, folks. I've just been doing nonstop eating and not a lot of moving for the past week, so I feel gross, to be honest. I am going to record this really quickly, and then I'm actually going to get on my trampoline. Do I have any other fellow rebounders out there? So I have I have this little mini trampoline. I love it. It's absolutely amazing exercise, easy on the joints. It's fun. You get a good sweat in. I'm a big fan. And I just want to say, like, coming home from a trip, this is where, God, I really, really, really miss Kiki. You know that feeling when you're out of town and you're coming home to your pet and you're just walking up the stairs, you're about to walk in, like, you're so excited. Like, I'd be so excited. I'd be so excited to see her. So it is hard, hard, hard. But just really, really missing my Kiki girl. And just want to give a shout out to Dion, who's in our community as well, who recently lost her kitty. So anything else I need to tell you? If you're new, welcome aboard. This is where we talk about what to do when you realize your childhood screwed you up a whole hell of a lot more than you initially thought it did. Buckle up. We curse here. I'm an acquired taste. Enjoy the ride. So today, my friends, we are diving deep with David Bedrick. Who be David Bedrick, you ask? Allow me to tell you. So David is a teacher, author, psychologist who has spent over 30 years helping people conquer their shame. He founded the Santa Fe Institute for Shame-Based Studies, where he teaches therapists, coaches, and healers on how to liberate shame from the mind and the body. And he has a new book that is coming out on November 26, 2024. It is called The Unshaming Way, Compassionate Guide to Dismantling Shame, Heal from Trauma, Unlearn Self-Blame, and Reclaim Your Story. I got an advanced copy of the book, so I am about 60% of the way through. Highly recommend it. So go see the link in the show notes. You can pre-order the book now. I do just want to say that Gabor Mate, or as we like to refer to him here as Gabor Mate, he wrote a little testimony regarding the book. He said, in this astute work, David Bedrick provides a deep investigation of shame, the most debilitating of our mind states, and offers a workable, practice-based, and accessible path to divesting ourselves from it. So we be talking shame today, and I know that no one relates to that at all, right? So I'm so glad that David is here to explain to us. So let's get on with it, folks. Let's get on with the damn show. But first, let's talk about why you need to damn the Join Shit Show. This is my online support community, where I host 4 weekly Zoom support groups where you connect with other people, where you can get access to a support system at your fingertips, in your back pocket. We get raw and real here. We have a lot of fun here. You're missing out, so how about you just do the thing, damn the join, less than a dollar a day. It's relational trauma. We heal this through safe relationships. See the link in the show notes. Do it now. Next, please give me a little follow on Insta, on the TikTok, at Adult Child Pod. And last but not least, whatever you do, give me a 5-star rating on Apple, on Spotify. Thank you and love you all. We're in for a damn treat, folks. We have David Bedrick. He's the author of the new book, which I was just reading, The Unshaming Way. And we are already fast friends, folks. We've already joking. We're cracking sick jokes. Just so you know, we curse here, so you can say whatever the fuck you want, David, okay?
Oh my gosh. My virgin ears.
Welcome.
Thank you. It's good to see you and enjoy your company already. Yeah.
So here's where I like to start always. When was the moment that you realized that your childhood screwed you up a whole lot more than you thought it did?
Well, I knew how bad my childhood was very young. For some reason, there was a part of me that was awake saying, this is wrong. Something's wrong. And by the age of 12 or 13, I started to write in a journal stories about what was happening. And my 12-year-old brain said, my parents must have forgotten what is obvious to me as a child, because they're not bad people. They just lost touch with it. I better write it down because I'll forget also. And guess what? By the time I was in my 20s, I forgot. And I started trying to behave the way I was conditioned to, traumatized to, et cetera. And then I had to open my eyes again to what I knew when I was a child. So when I was 30, I was in graduate school and wanted to leave, and it was a horror story. And I had married a person. I was going to say it's the wrong person. I don't know. Life is right. I understand. But it was not the person that I am with and meant to be with. And it was a product of my conditioning, not of my soul or heart. And the ending of that and the horror of graduate school sunk me. Boom. Like it. And that shipwrecked my life. And that's when I went, oh my gosh. The stories of my childhood are much more woven into the imprisonment of my freedom than I had realized.
Do you want to talk about how that was showing up? Like, why was grad school such a horror show? We like details here.
Yeah, I loved psychology since I was very young. I was reading like Freud on dreams and not understanding it, you know, literally when I was very young. I just loved it, like writing down dreams and all the kind of stuff, not knowing what I was doing with those things. And I always thought for many years, I'm going to study psychology, which as a child, that meant I'm going to be a psychologist, not a, you know, whatever, an organizational analyst or something like that. I was going to sit with people and do what people call therapy. When I was about to apply to graduate school, I had an uncle who was very powerful influence in my family life. Everyone looked up to him as the wise patriarch, so to speak, if we can say it that way, meaning people thought he was smarter than everybody else at what to do. My first year of college was awful grades-wise because I got more interested in drugs than I did in school. So I had got really bad grades. This uncle, Jack, convinced me and my family, my father especially, who was the influence around my education, convinced me that I shouldn't apply to clinical psychology programs because my grades were so bad my first year. I did super well after that. Said, you're never going to get into a good school. You should look at other options. And I believed him. I was open to that influence. I didn't have, but some people have you at 18 or 19 or 20, you know, whatever, you know, I'm not going to listen to you. I didn't have that kind of self-empowerment. So I applied instead to organizational psychology programs. I wasn't interested. I didn't even know what it was. So in a way, I wrote down at that point, I never chose to do this. Do you know what I mean? I chose, I get it. But this person just chose something based on what other people told him to do. And that was a nightmare because, of course, when you choose to do something that's not you, a part of you doesn't go along with you, right? Your energy, your passion, your love, your body gets symptoms, things like that happen. And that literally made a nightmare of it for me.
And so what did that look like when you hit this bottom? Was there a realization that you had endured trauma? Like, was there a realization that you had trauma that needed to be healed?
I don't think I thought of it. I didn't think of it that way in that language, but I understood the same conclusions. The conclusions of I was locked into a story that was my own. I had a father who was used fists and belts to express his rage. I had a mother who was so disempowered that all she could do was deny that it was happening, even though it was like not hidden. Or she watched, you know, and screamed and said, ah, stop, right? So it wasn't hidden. In my 30s, I learned a lot more about what lived in me intergenerationally as a Jewish human being and how that story played into my family violence and my own violence. But I didn't think of it in the same language that we use today. Trauma was used back then, but not nearly as much. I'm 68 years old, so it wasn't so popular a language. Mm-hmm. Trauma was used around wartime. PTSD was a war thing. It wasn't a domestic violence thing or a child thing. You know, the ideas that were birthed post-Holocaust, really, when people started studying this thing of something is going on that looks like it's locking people into patterns and difficulties, especially intergenerationally.
Yeah. Epigenetics.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what was that experience like? What did you learn? How did you learn it? How did that play a role in your healing?
Well, there's so much to say. The first thing that comes up for me when you ask are people. Some were teachers, lovers, friends, authors, people who I felt one got it. You know, whatever that getting means, they understood something about that. I have a picture of James Baldwin on my desk for the last 30 years. That's James Baldwin. And he got it. So I read him, kept him around for me. I read letters he wrote to his nephews and read them as if they were written to me. Wow. And even though I didn't have a Black, you know, adolescence living in Harlem, I still felt like he understood.
Well, you didn't?
Okay. But he understood that. And then I had some teachers who taught me, I'm going to say love me, and that's a forbidden word for some reason. Mm-hmm. But I felt love from them, and I needed that. Mm-hmm. I needed not just people who were smart, therapeutic. I needed to feel that I
connected,
that cared about me a lot, that I meant a lot to them. And those people seeing me and caring about my life helped a lot because I didn't have that orientation towards myself mm-hmm. that they had towards me. Some people say, you have to love yourself first. And I think I had a lot of people having to love me for me to be able to sit here with you to write a book. Not that I don't learn to love myself also, but it's not quite one versus the other for me. And now I have a partner for 20 years who loved the shit out of me, and it makes a lot of difference in my sense of security. And I don't have my own inner security so strong that it would be independent of the people around me shoring me up. And yeah. So people loving me, people I can tell my story to, made a really big, I was at a workshop when I was 34, 35 years old. So it's about 30 years ago. And that was the first time I told the story of the violence that my brother, I had one sibling, an older brother, 5 years older, and he was particularly cruel. He was sadistic. That's not just like he beat me up when we had fights. He was cruel and practiced cruelty as an expression of him. It wasn't like, I mean, I'm angry with you. So there was a kind of sadism. I don't say that lightly, like everyone, people are sadists, you know, I mean that. So
do you think it was stuff that was being done to him by your dad that he was then doing to you?
I think it was intergenerational mm-hmm. because my father's violence was out of rage. Mm-hmm. Different kind, right? Oh, I can't stand it anymore. The kids, and I just wanted to beat somebody. That's not an excuse, right? That's like, that's disgusting. Somebody should have stopped him. But that's a different orientation than, let's say a person who's going to experiment on animals and hurt them and see what they do. That's a different kind of, right? That's a different kind of expression. Mm-hmm. And the first time I told that story, I was in a room with about 120, 130 people. And somebody said to me, turn around. I was like sitting near the front of a circular form of a group. Mm-hmm. I turned around and I saw all these people with tears in their eyes. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know until then that what I was saying was that impactful, because I couldn't see your eyes and your heart or your fury or your anger. I couldn't see you being moved. So I'm just thinking, this is what happened to me. And all these people were crying. And I was like, oh, that really is a moving story that I needed. I'm going to call that a witness, somebody to reflect back. That's a powerful experience you're talking about. Yeah, it was an awakening.
How were you treated compared to your brother in your home growing up as a kid?
My brother was older. He got the physical part of my father's violence more directly. So I was younger. I was more terrified. So my father come into the bedroom with a belt in his hand in a rage. That wasn't like, you need to be punished. Not that that would be okay to wait to punish, but that's a different experience, right? He'd be coming in a rage. He'd like, he had a belt in his hand. My mother would be screaming, Marty, right? This kind of thing. And my brother was more likely to speak back, more likely to get in the way. I'd be like curled up somewhere on the bed, kind of going, God damn, you know, like just freaking out. So he got that physical violence more. I got more of the violence of watching people I love get hurt and living frightened, because my brother was frightened of my father, but he wasn't around all the time. But mm-hmm. I was frightened of my brother, mm-hmm. my father and my brother. I had mm-hmm. a small apartment, so I lived in the same room with my brother. So in a sense, I'm never out of my body. And the truth of it is I'm never out of danger living in my home. So I had normalized that, as many people do. I just walk around. It's really interesting. I was talking to I teach people how to work with people, therapy skills and facilitation skills. And then I realized something I told my recent students. I said, I grew up thinking I was shy. I'm not a shy person. I was scared.
You're terrified.
Yeah. So it's like shyness is different. Like if you meet me, you'll think he's not a shy person. I talk to strangers. I love having conversation with you. If you ask me things, I get animated. I'm not like, ooh, I don't want to tell you that. I can be vulnerable. But actually, so it's interesting that I learned to interpret my experience by the way other people labeled it. So I walked around thinking, I'm a shy person. And you can see how that distances me from my story and the truth. The truth is, I'm terrified. That's very different than being shy. Shy looks like a personality trait. Terrified is a story and an experience that lives in me in a way I'm seeing the world and feeling in the world. So I call that part of shame, you see, because rather than say, let me tell you my story as you're asking, let me tell you about the terror that lives in my body as you're talking about, that you can get to know me. Instead, I think I'm a shy person. Maybe I shouldn't be so shy. What's wrong with me? I should work on my shyness. So all that I call pathologization. Let me look at the problem of shyness in the world as a part of, that means I should fix myself. I should address myself. What's wrong with me? Why am I like this? Am I so shy? I have to get over that. So now I'm going to go to shyness education classes so I can be having more of a voice. Right? And that's what people do. I call that shame because they're interpreting. Yeah, they're interpreting their experiences, which have stories and real experiences, as something wrong with them to fix. There's nothing to fix. I have a story.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I'm fascinated about this, realizing at the age of 12 that your parents forgot something and you needed to. Do you remember having that initial thought?
I thought exactly that way. I wrote it down in my journals. That's why I remember it so well. Yeah.
Do you think you told anybody about that?
Not at the time. Nobody. Yeah. I wrote to my journal. So you could say I'm writing to myself. I would say I was writing to something that I didn't know about because I was writing to somebody. But who was that to? But it's interesting. People who knew me then, even when I was 6, 7 years old, I have a best friend that I was out of touch with for many years, James, but in the last years I'm more in touch with. And he always said to me, oh, David, you are always like this teaching person trying to help people with their, you know, with the way they were. So in some sense, a part of me acted out of that. I didn't have as much to teach as I have it. Maybe I did. I don't know. The heart of me was still that same part of me. But I was always looking at people, seeing these things, trying to help people. I always befriended people who were having a more difficult time, people of other races, other styles. So I always had a sense of living out of that experience. Yeah.
Yeah, I was flipping through your book and I was thinking about, so for me, and yeah. I would like to talk with you about this maybe like at some point, but for me, the abuse, the trauma, the neglect that I endured was very subtle in certain ways. I was the scapegoat. I was the identified patient.
Yes.
I was never told that I was a piece of shit ever. I was never really verbally abused. Yeah. I was always told that I was loved, you know? And so I had no idea how little I thought about myself. I thought on a conscious level that I had high self-esteem, high self-worth, but my choices and behaviors and relationships clearly showed otherwise, yeah. You know? And so it was quite a shock to really come to terms with my toxic shame.
Yeah.
I also noticed that for me, that the inner critic isn't necessarily as loud. It's almost more of a felt sense. And I'm wondering if a lot of that has to do with maybe not being subjected to verbal abuse. But I'm just curious, what was your journey of realizing how much internalized shame you had? Like, what was that unfolding process like? And how did you learn about it? And
I want to say a couple of things about what you're bringing forward. There's no small abuses and trauma. Whenever a person compares, well, that person, not that we can't look at socially, you know, wars and violence, we can socially, But when a person individually is saying, my story is not as powerful, important as, that person is minimizing their story.
What I like to say is, it's not about what happened to you. It's about what you came to believe about yourself as a result of what happened.
That's
to
right.
You. Yeah.
And the way we come to faith, this is the critical thing about shame and the learning that I've had about what we need to learn next about shame and from what we've already known. The way shame enters is not by the violence itself. It's by the way it's witnessed. So if somebody mistreats you, that hurts you. But if somebody says to you, that's a small thing, that's not a big deal, or treats you like it's not a big deal, then you then think of it's not a big deal. So then you dismiss or minimize that. So in my case, if I have a mother who says, what are you talking about? Your father's a great guy. Then I don't, my father's violence is bad. It causes the injury. But the healing problem is not about the violator. The healing, the perpetrating problem, the violence is my father. That's clear. No dismissal about that. No minimization of that. But the healing problem is what I come to believe about that. Why do I make things up? Why do I have anger problems? How come I'm so shy? That's the healing problem. And I want to tell you another story. I was working with a woman who said to me, she was also a student, and she said, sounded a little bit like you, echoes at least your story. She said, I don't think I have like a lot of inner criticism. I didn't grow up with a lot of violence, but I have these patterns and stories. And I said to her, what was it like growing up? And she had brothers, and they were deferred to when people were talking at the table. They listened to the brothers, valued their voices more. But nobody said, you're stupid, shut up, you're a girl, we don't listen to girls. Nobody intentionally put internalized sexism into her head, right? But she lived with it. And I said, could you take that attitude, the boys should be listening to, not you, and make words out of it? I know no one said it, but make words. And she said, well, girls shouldn't be listening to you. You're dumb. You're not worth listening to. You're not as important, she said. And I said, great. Make that more extreme. Let those words come out of you with the way you felt in you, because it felt pain, very painful. And she said, then she gets a little bit meaner. I'm not saying that people are saying that, but when I ask people to do that so they can hear the sound of words that weren't said, but you feel them, you know, right? A gay person walks into a place, they kind of go, I don't belong here. No one has to say, we're homophobic here, we are hateful towards queers. No one has to say those words. So I said, say those words louder to me and clearer. Just go for it. Just let yourself speak freely. And she says, you shouldn't speak. You're dumb. In fact, you should get lost. You should erase you. In fact, and then I got to say, this is like a triggering thing. Then she said, you'd be better off if you weren't here. You'd be better off if you were dead. Whoa. Even, I don't even want to say that out loud, even because people think, well, but that's what she experienced. Mm-hmm. Well, even now I'm like at to chills. I want to like stop and weep for a little while because it feels like so forbidden even to say that here. But that's what lives inside of her. So someone might say, that's not as bad as, but think about the message that goes in. And then think about the other people at the table and no one saying, hey, when you treat her like she doesn't exist, that's not okay with me. Sweetheart, you have a beautiful voice. I want to hear what you have to say. Everyone be quiet. Let's ask Susie her opinion. If that doesn't happen by the other people watching, then she starts feeling that it makes sense that she's treated that way. What is wrong with me? Why do I feel depressed? Why do I feel so hateful? How come my esteem is low? How come I attract and want to please every single person? Then she starts going to therapy thinking, what's wrong with me? As opposed to, I took in a message that was violent and no one defended me. So I think that's what I must be worthy of, not must not be worthy of defending and speaking for. Anyway, that's a lot to say. But I just want to amplify this thing that looks small, but the insidiousness of the deadliness of it is enormous.
And most people can go their entire lives not realizing that it's in there, you know? So.
Right. Anyway, I lost track of you were asking me a self-reflective question.
Yeah, no, but you know what, saying that, what that kind of makes me think of is the, you know, it's like the reaction to it. It makes me think about this time where I came into school and this kid that I was friends with, he came up to me and he goes, CJ's dad says that you sleep in your mom's bed every night. And my dad had played tennis with CJ's dad.
Oh.
And just thinking about just, it is the witnessing of that, of like a, Andrea's a nuisance. I'm not sleeping because she can't sleep in her own bed. She has to sleep with her mom. But it's not because clearly there's nothing wrong going on in the home. You know what I mean? It is that witnessing of there's something wrong with you, and it's for absolutely no reason other than there's something wrong with you.
This is the painful thing. I work with a woman who was I always get careful because I don't want to just trigger people, but she was raped as an adult, and then
we're fine. You can say it. We're good. It's a trigger warning every episode here, so you're good.
Oh, great. So she went to she was Catholic and went to a priest, and the priest said, you should learn to forgive. Mm. When she goes to therapy, which she came to me at some point, you know what she comes saying? I need help with my forgiveness. I'm not able to let go. So can you see? So that priest wasn't the sexual abuser, but her interpretation of her experience is, I have a forgiveness problem. So now she comes, isn't that painful? So now she comes with the witness. Again, is not letting the abuser off the hook. That person should be stopped and whatever, and all those kind of things, and punished appropriately, you know, and et cetera. But in her psyche, she thinks, what's wrong with me? Forgiveness problem. I can't let go. I don't need to learn. I need to learn to forgive. So she doesn't have a story anymore. She doesn't know why she's like the way she doesn't know that her anger and upsetness has power that she needs in her life to live effective relationships. So she could say, no, screw you, back off. I have boundaries. She needs all that power to do that. But then she goes to she interprets that. Again, I'm not trying to pick on Catholic priests. It could be a new age guru could say the same thing. But essentially she's interpreting her experience in a certain way, disempowering herself, thinking her anger and her upset doesn't belong, is not part of her power in life that she needs as a person, as a woman person in the world, instead of what's wrong with me. And then she's going to go to a lot of people and they're going to say, oh, let me give you forgiveness practice. And those people are complicit in taking away her boundaries, taking away her power, denying and dismissing her story. They're one more witness who agrees, even unconsciously, they don't mean to, but they're agreeing, you don't have a trauma and abuse story. You weren't mistreated as a woman. You don't have a gender story as a woman who's been raped that many other women would know about, that you have solidarity with. All that's gone. What you have is a forgiveness problem, and you need psychological or spiritual help. I call that pathologization. We made a sickness. She's sick, as opposed to a person with a story who maybe she wants to tell that story. Maybe she wants to use that fire to write a book, or to start a podcast, or to come on with you and say, I'm a woman furious about rape and informing other women. None of that happened. She says, poor me, what's wrong with me? And that's, to me, is shame. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's the insidiousness of shame. Yeah, sorry, I get really,
My question was, what was your process of coming to terms with your own shame?
Sure. Ongoing.
Like when you had that moment, when you hit that bottom, in a sense, after grad school, was shame even in the lexicon of words in your head at the time?
It was not.
I think that's the first time I've ever actually used that word, like, in talking. So
That's really nice. I like it.
Jacob Baird.
Let's take a moment. Good work.
I'm sorry.
I love it. I love sometimes like a little poetic phrase comes in my mouth. That sounds really good, you know? It's better than negative self-talk, right?
Does it sound good when you have to point it out? But okay.
It sounds really good. When I was in my mid-30s, I was teaching at a university of Phoenix. And
psychology?
I was teaching psychology. And I became really interested in, you know, people talk about love and loving yourself. And I was thinking, I wonder what this thing is, love anyway. Like, people talk about it. What is this like? And I love researching. I'm kind of a studier. So I decided, I'm going to ask people, what's it like to feel loved? And if they could tell a story and put it on like a little index card. So I collected lots of these things and then I grouped them. Oh, that one sounds like this. That one sounds like this. Well, I asked people what it feels like to be loved, and people had a very hard time answering that question. So I said, what's it like to not feel loved? Well, people had a lot of stories about that. So I collected those instead. And then I grouped them into like my subjectivity. This looks like people not feeling loved. And people had three main kinds of stories. One was not being seen or heard. I just treated you like you don't exist, or your feelings don't matter. And the other was not being cared about. I didn't have a feeling response. I wasn't moved by you, liking you, upset when you got hurt, showing you my warmth, etc. There was no feeling, care. And the other was people were not believed. Mm. And believed meant not just you didn't believe when I told my abuse story, but you didn't believe in me. But no one believed in me, that there was something intelligent, good, powerful, amazing in me. And later, so I started studying how that happened. And I ended up calling, that was my beginning to thinking about shame. I think this experience people have lives inside of them as attitudes towards themselves. I don't believe myself. I don't care about myself. I don't really listen to in my own experience to get to know myself. And I thought that wraps around people, wraps around their experience there. It filters the way they get to know themselves. So that was my first introduction to what I started to think of. I should study that more. And that was 30 years ago. That's what I've been studying for 30 years. I've gotten to know a bit more about how that happens.
And you spoke about not living in your truth and studying the organizational psychologies. In what ways was shame impacting your life in the most profound ways?
The most profound way is when shame is pervasive, which is for most people in some way. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by shame is not only I feel this terrible, painful feeling, because shame not only, if I'm ashamed of my intelligence, I think I'm really bright. Ooh, I better not act too bright. I should act humble. Mm-hmm. Then I don't only feel ashamed in front of you. I hide from myself also. So most people don't have shame feelings that they can recognize. Mm-hmm. They just hide things from themselves. I just try to act like a different person. So there are various, so the biggest pain for me and for many people around shame is what you were saying. I stop living the path that's mine. Mm-hmm. I start conforming. So I start saying, how do I be a certain kind of person to my partner and in my relationships, in my work life? How do I evaluate my success according to these criteria? So I start navigating a life path that's not really mine. So you can say that graduate school experience of studying clinical psychology was. Uh-huh. I started a business doing organizational psychology. That was fine, but it really wasn't me. And I didn't love it. Mm-hmm. So I live a whole life and then I'm acting like certain ways in relationship that are more like I'm going to be a good partner. This is what a good man is supposed to be like. That's what I should do. There's some good things about that, but I'm not living out of my own heart. I'm choosing relationships that are not exactly mine. Some of the life I create is not exactly mine. And then I'm not sitting here. I'm not writing 4 books. I'm not teaching the things that I have to teach. If you're a person who loves children, you're not having those children. You're not meeting the lovers that you're meant to be in love with. You're not writing poetry if you're meant to write poetry. You're not being quiet if you're meant to write quiet. So I wasn't living a life geared towards myself until I was about 36. I stopped doing certain things. I met somebody, a teacher, who really influenced me. And I thought, I think what they're teaching is kind of like what lives inside of me.
And what was that?
I had a teacher who lives inside of me. And I wanted to teach what I now call unshaming. I wanted to teach folks that there's something that lives inside of them that gets covered over, that if we get to know and nourish, not only do we get less pain and symptoms, but we start living the life that's meant for us and developing the intimacies and beauty that we have. I didn't know that I had a path like that. I didn't know I wanted to study a certain kind of psychology. I would call that depth psychology until I met a man named Arne Mandel. Was a Jungian analyst, and he died about 2 months ago. Hey, Ernie, he's a beautiful soul. Man. So I watched him teach, and I can tell you the story of what I saw, and I was like, oh, please. My gosh, I'm leaving my business, I'm leaving my relationships. I want to, like, somehow I knew.
Arnie,
exactly. Somehow I knew that being around him, I was going to find myself again.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
So when you talk about the witnessing of the shame, so you talk about it's not so much your father's violence.
Yes.
But your mother's witnessing.
Yes.
And so then is it through, it's through the witnessing of others that the shame is then internalized, and then we become there becomes an internalized witness.
Exactly what happens. That's right.
Can you explain that?
Yeah, that happens in the culture also. It's interesting. Some people who listen, and I'm sure you know about Larry Nassar. He was he's a
gymnast doctor.
Yeah, mm-hmm. For the women's
Olympic team. Yeah,
Olympic team, and also for the Michigan University mm-hmm. of Michigan. Mm-hmm. Was it? And so he sexually violated women for 20 years, right? For 20 years. So there's a couple of interesting things. Well, eventually, took a woman prosecutor, by the way, to actually charge him. And then he went to court and lost and was convicted and for violating an incredible number of women. It took 160 women to come forward. 160 before that took 20 years. And most women don't come forward, right? So you think, to your question, how come 160? Why 20 years? That because we don't have an entire culture that takes seriously. So we're seeing an eating disorder. We're not thinking something's going on. Girls are coming home at 14 years old to their parents and telling them the stories. The parents aren't saying, they're saying, well, you know, he's a doctor, so I'm sure he's not, etc. The FBI is spoken to. A university presence is spoken to. Other doctors are spoken to. And girls or women, young women are going to their doctors for their gynecological exams. Stories are coming out. How come they're not saying, holy shit? Because there's a whole culture from teachers, from parents, from to FBI, to prosecutors, to police, to other university instructors who are witnessing the story and saying, that's not what you think. That may reinterpret that story. So then those people walk around thinking, I'm confused. Why am I depressed? How come I'm suicidal? Some of those people are suicidal. How come I'm angry all the time? Why can't I get close to people? How come I'm closed up? Why am I getting excessive symptoms and cramps that are related to the kind of sexual violence we know today? So the story they tell themselves is not a sexual abuse story. Now, when those women came forward, the judge was amazing. And she said, also a woman, she said, any witness, anybody who wants to come forward during the sentencing, you can tell a witness story. I don't care if that takes days, because I'm going to make a public forum for the stories to be heard by people. Now, I've listened to, I don't know, as many of those stories as are available. And I'll tell you the story those women tell. Very little about Larry Nassar. He's convicted. Again, I'm not dismissing him. That guy should be convicted. All the terrible things, yes, right? The stories they tell are about all the people they told that didn't believe them. That's the witness story. That's not the violation story, but it's the witness story, because that's what they come to believe about themselves. That's where the shame lives. So that's what I'm saying. So that's why those witness stories are so important. That's why we need Me Too stories, not only of this is the person who violated me, and these are the people I told, or Andrea, even worse, these are the people I didn't tell because I would never tell that person because I know they would patronize me, not believe me, act like it was no big deal, dismiss me. And I can't bear that, because if you dismiss, deny, neglect, gaslight me, that could be deadly for me. Because if I'm moved by a painful story and you act like nothing's happening, I can't bear that. Now I feel like I'm not worth even caring about. I'm hit and lying bloody on the street and you're walking by like nothing's happening. That can lead me to a suicide, because I don't matter. Abusing me can be suicidal, but if you act like it doesn't matter, it looks like it's not as important. But for my suicidality, that could be more important than the actual violence.
But yeah. Touch upon the when that's self-inflicted. And I would imagine once it's internalized, it is creating these glasses with lenses that are viewing things in such a distorted way that just further deepens and ingrains the shame, which really can make it very difficult to get out of.
All right, my shit show ladies, let me tell you about how I can make getting dressed so much easier for you. Armoire is a clothing rental membership where you get to build your perfect wardrobe with brands that are high quality, unique, and recommended just for you. All you got to do is take a 5-minute style quiz and then select from your personalized closet. The styles show up at your door in as little as 2 days. Then when you're ready for new clothes, just swap them out for more new to you styles. So I love this because I'm on video quite often on interviews and social media content, and I don't want people to be like, is that the only shirt that this girl owns? I also would not consider myself in the know of what's hot and what's not. But with Armoire, I get to pretend like I'm a fashionista. So this is perfect for working moms, for stay-at-home moms, for any women who just don't feel like going to the store. Now, right now, you shit show ladies can give Armoire a try and get up to 50% 50% off your first month. So that is up to $125 off. Just visit armoire.style/adultchild. That is armoire.style, armoire.style/adultchild to get 50% off your first month and never worry about what to wear ever again. Okay, shit show dudes, you can tune out. This is for my fellow shit show ladies. Are you going through perimenopause or menopause? I'm not quite there yet, but I know that I have plenty to look forward to. Feeling like a wet sock driving down the highway. Night sweats. Poor sleep. Feeling tired all the time. Bloating. Gas. Man, can't wait for this shit. Now, if that is applicable to you, then you have to try Hormone Harmony. So Hormone Harmony is not just a supplement for women going through perimenopause, menopause, or postmenopause. It's become a phenomenon. Women cannot stop talking about it. A bottle of Hormone Harmony is sold every 24 fucking seconds, okay? Now, Happy Mammoth, the company that created Hormone Harmony, is dedicated to making women's lives easier using only science-backed ingredients that have been proven to work. Now, for my younger shit show women like myself, if you struggle from that vicious week before your period, you want to crawl out of your skin, experience cravings, want to eat everything in the damn house, you feel a little bit down or off, well, Happy Mammoth also has a product for you to make it easier to manage your PMS with their Estro Control. So for a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code adultchild at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use the code adultchild for 15% off today.
Most people don't know that there's shame there. They come, like I worked with people for one-on-one for 30 plus years. People come saying, I've been working on my procrastination for X number of years. Mm-hmm. Can you help me stop procrastinating? Because I really should be focusing on fill in the blank and I'm not. And they say, this is wrong with me. I'm a procrastinator. Fix my procrastination problem. And they don't have a story. They don't have a discussion about the inner critic that says, you're an asshole. Of course, I don't want to sit and focus on my writing. If I'm sitting there with an inner critic saying, David, you're an idiot. No one's ever going to read your stuff. That's not a procrastination problem. That's called self-hatred and self-shame problem. Yeah. So people bring problems that aren't that. A woman came to me and said, I've been working on my anger for 10 years. How come I can't make it go away? That's a shame problem. How come she's not saying, there's a lot of anger in me. I don't know what to do with it. Help me contact it. Where does it belong? Does it belong to a story? Do I still need that in my life? That would be an unshamed story. But she's coming to therapy, not saying, what do I do with this power and energy that lives inside of me? Can you hear the difference? That's a very different human being than, what's wrong with me? Help me get rid of my anger. Can you help me regulate and meditate so I'm not so angry? Yes, don't hurt people. Meditate if you're going to hurt your kids so you don't injure them. But then find out what's living inside of you. I call that unshaming. And where does it belong? Those are life sources of energy. So most people come with that shame problem, not describing shame. They just say, I'm too this and I'm not enough that. I'm too sensitive. I'm too upset. I can't focus. I'm taking drugs and I don't know why. Can you help me stop doing that? I eat too much. I don't eat enough. I'm doing things wrong. Fix me. I'm broken. Something's wrong with me. Mm-hmm. That's shame, although people call that healing. Mm-hmm. That's how radical it's almost never do people come with a desire to unshame. They come pathologizing themselves. There's something wrong with me. Please fix that.
Yeah. Why do you think that for so many people, it's so scary to acknowledge that it's shame? It's so much easier and safer to think it's something else.
Yeah.
Especially for men, I would say.
Yeah, too. Both in different forms. If you live in a family or a system around you or a culture that doesn't say, we would love Andrea to be her deepest, most powerful, most wonderful self, right? Please be the most sensitive woman that you really are. Please bring the most powerful woman you really are. Please be the most intelligent woman you are. Please be the sexiest, most powerful woman and interesting and attractive woman you are. Please be the most revolutionary woman you are. If we had a culture that doesn't do that, then shame is going to be reinforced because shame says, be less of all those things. And then the culture and systems around you will say, oh, isn't that great? She's pretty and thin and lovely and she's never upsetting anybody. Isn't she great to get along with? Wow, she's so lovely. She's so sweet. It's so great to be around her. He never interrupts me. He always listens to every word I say. Boy, I love Andrea.
I'm being
sarcastic. But then we have a culture that supports shame's operation, which is to have you hide and diminish aspects of yourself. So how lovely. Then everyone's going to, then church is going to like you, and the temple's going to like you, and the mosque is going to like you, and some family systems will like you, and the culture will like you, and other people will comment on your looks and not on your billions. And that isn't that great. So they bring in the body shame thing, because being thin, so everything is kind of saying, be that way, and we're going to praise you like hell. And by the way, if you decide as a woman, I'm going to be really powerful, you're a B, you're this, you're that, we don't like her, she's kind of aggressive, what's going on there? We're going to, she thinks Ching's propinners are so good. So we're going to be critical of her and saying that would then support shame, unless you knew. And you kind of go, of course, I live in a culture that puts me down. I'm not going to take that shit. No shame is going to enter. But if you think, oops, I overdid it, I am too much, it's true. Now shame has entered and you will start censoring yourself. And then you'll talk too much at one moment. And then, oh my, you'll say, why did I talk so much? I should have held myself back. Shame will reassert itself. And the people around you will support that. And then you're, therapist, if they're not good, will say, yeah, you do talk too much. Let me help you with talking too much. That would be gross. Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah. What are you thinking?
Exactly.
Nobody can relate to that, I'm sure. Right?
Not a single person.
Yeah. No one has that. No one has that dilemma.
Well, I wanted to ask, how did things unfold with your family as you began to heal?
Mm-hmm.
What did your relationship with your brother look like?
Yeah.
What does it look like now, if he's alive? What did it look like with your parents? Did you did any of them find any sort of healing?
My mother and father had both passed. My father and I had very rough years, and into my later 30s, he became more tender as he got older, especially after his first heart attack. That's not uncommon for men.
Mm-hmm.
That as death, mortality comes, not all men, but mortality sometimes makes it like, you know what? I think maybe there's some love between me and my children, in this case, me and my son, and my evaluations and criticism maybe are less important, so that can happen. So he became.
So I should hope that my dad has a heart attack? Is that what you're saying?
Well, see, in a way, more awareness that that life may not go on forever. But it's still, some men go to their grave and kind of go. So my dad resisted. We had a lot of fights. But at one point, my dad said to me, Marty, he said, I was a real bastard when you were growing up, wasn't I? And I said, you were.
Mm.
And we had some tears. And that was a forgiveness moment, you come to call them. That's not all gone, right? But that was his world. And then we had we had much more tender moments, many more tender moments over the years. My mother and I, it was much more painful because I wanted her to one day say something like, David, I saw, this is what happened. Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh. Whatever her words, that would mean the same thing. I should have protected you. You were unprotected. I now see the kind of violence you were subject to. Oh my gosh, I love you, my son. Big, deepest apologies for what you went through. She wouldn't have to sit and berate herself. Some kind of, however you get that dose. I wanted that, Andrea, so bad. I'm going to say I begged. I wasn't on my hand, but in different ways, I was like, but mom, I challenged. And she never opened to that. And I don't know how long that took me, but maybe up until 40 or something before I was capable and breathing enough, I'm going to say, that woman, David, you're looking at, she cannot and will not do that. I'm not saying, therefore, you should hate her or love her or forgive her. I'm just saying, can you look honestly and clearly at this person and say, they will not capable of whatever it is, they will never give that to you. And before that, I couldn't give it up because I had a hope. I needed it from somewhere. I needed it from many places. She couldn't give it. That changed my relationship with her. It made me more open to her in certain ways, more boundary with her in certain ways. But I was like, oh, that's the mother I got. Again, I'm not saying that's a good thing. Oh, okay, that's lovely.
Well, it's too painful for her to go there.
Yeah.
Couldn't go there.
Yeah.
What that meant about herself, you know?
Yeah. We had better moments after that were unrelated. 2 years before my mom died, she died of cancer. she started losing her normal mind, right? So she would mistake me for my brother, or wouldn't, or I would go to see her and she'd look at me and, who are you? And say weird things. So whatever, forms of dementia, et cetera. Those were our best years, because this is my unshaming way, says, don't demand, she can't do it. That's not her mind, right? Treat her like she is that way. Not like try to get her to be same. She's not going to act like the person that I think she should be. So I made up names for her that were her name. And we would have the greatest discussions. I sometimes called her Mamacita. You know, Mamacita, what should we do today? I'd be on the phone. She'd say, who is this? I'd say, this is Davido or something. And she'd say, oh, yeah, you called me. Are you my son? You know, and I'd say, yeah, let's go on a trip. Yeah, I would like to go on a cruise. And we would have these great discussions, and we would travel together in our imaginations and play and be silly. And one time, Andrea, this is so tender, it makes me cry. She said to me, you are my son. I said, yeah. She said, how did you get to be such a good person? She never said anything like that to me in our whole, anything ever. She never praised me. And I was like, I could still weep. This was, I don't know how many years ago. I was like, oh my gosh. That was like, I took something in that I was a taste of the things that I wanted from her. But she was a little, I'm going to say wacky, but you know what I mean? Her mind wasn't, but the beauty of her mind not being the same way is she was no longer the person who was so hard and difficult to get along with. That was the good part about it. Not everyone gets like that way when they become demented, but she did. We also had some painful moments at that time. So she was not, sometimes she flipped into her worst self also. But there were moments that were kind of sweet, but not about talking about our past. No, that she never opened, even though she was violated.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, do you know much about her childhood?
She grew up with a father who was very rough. I don't know about the physical violence, but I know the way he treated her and dismissed her and treated her only sibling, her brother, vastly different. Yeah, so I know that level. She never talked about her father's physical violence when I asked. But she would talk about him as being very strict, right? So I'm 68. At that time, men strict, meaning you were definitely getting a backhand and things like that was considered like regular treatment. And she was then programmed to be proper girl growing into a woman, right? Which meant fold your hands, be nice, don't speak back. So those kinds of gender censoring, you know, act this way, whatever. Be pretty, thin, shut your mouth. I'm not trying to, you know... I worked, but she was a smoker for 40 years, two packs a day.
Wow.
I remember working with another woman who was roughly my mother's age. This wouldn't be true for all women. And I helped them with their smoking. I do this unshaming process, which is, I think what people do is intelligent. We just don't know what the intelligence is saying. Not that it's a good idea to smoke cigarettes. That's not good for your lungs. I'm not stupid about that. But I think a person smoking, they're doing something. So I said to this person, can you show me how you smoke? Let's do it with a pen. Put a pen in your hands like a cigarette. I'll put a pen in my hand and we'll make believe you're smoking. Why would you do that? Because I don't know what you're doing. I said, I want to learn what you're actually doing. And the person, I have something out of him. So the person picked up a pen and I picked up my pen, and people may not be able to see it. And they took a puff like, and they inhaled, and then they looked up, their head looked up, and they blew out the smoke like, shh. Like you can imagine, if you can't see it, your head going back and you're blowing the smoke in this kind of lovely little moment. So I said, let's do that more. And she would go and suck in the smoke into her lungs, and blow out the air up into the sky. And then I said, go put your head back like you did when you blew the air, the smoke up, and do that a few times. And she put her head back and blew the air up. I said, let's do it a few more times and tell me what it's like. She said, oh my gosh, it's such a wonderful vacation. This 6 second, 3 second thing. So some women I know, because I work with many, not all, smoking is different for different people, but some women use smoking to take a break. And my mother had that pattern with my father, because she would learn to be a woman with a man in that time, which meant she was good and shut up. And now every so often she would say, yes, I'm listening. Well, that's very important. Yeah, I'm nodding my head and paying attention. And then every so often her head would go back to the cigarette and she wouldn't care about anything he had to say. And she wasn't under the grip of that violence. And she was off in the sky going wherever she wanted, saying, screw you. I don't care about what you have to say. Actually, I'm more interested in blowing smoke into the sky. So cigarettes had that intelligence If you follow what I mean by intelligence. Mm-hmm. And better if she could have said, shut up, I need a break from you. I'm going to go take a vacation. That would have been better. But she couldn't do that.
Vacation.
Yeah, but she couldn't do the cigarettes. And so cigarettes formed that, had that intelligence in it. It only took 20 minutes to find that help from somebody. It doesn't take a long time. You just have to do an unshaming thing, which is, I want to learn about what you're actually doing. Maybe it's intelligent, as opposed to, let me help you get rid of it.
Mm. Yeah. Okay, I want to hear about your brother.
My brother and I had, in my early 30s, I tried like hell to build a relationship with him and talked. And I thought at that age, that meant talking about what had happened, what he had done to me, what happened in our family. And he said, I'm not open to having any of those discussions. I won't talk to you about the family. I will talk to you about our father. And I won't address anything that happened between us. He didn't say all those words directly, but that was his message. And some of that was really direct. I tried really hard and it didn't work. And I was like, now what do I do? And my brother was not physically violent to me once he left the home and mm-hmm. I had left. Mm-hmm. But he still had that same attitude that was very hurtful in his manner and his treatment. And that went on for quite a while until I cut off my relationship with him and said, no more. I won't be open to this kind of treatment. And that went on every so often. Maybe years would go by, I'd reach out and maybe there's a connection. Mm-hmm. Things looked and smelled the same, felt the same. He never really reached out to me. And it was about a year ago, I moved to California. He lives in California. And it had been years again. I thought, let me see how he's doing. You never know. And we met over dinner. He was with a new woman in his life. And I don't know if that was the reason, but something in him had shifted. There's no way we're going to talk about our history. The door would close. So I'm not going to resolve things with him. You have to resolve that in other ways inside, with Goddess, with spirit, with my friends, with my therapist, whatever. I'm going to resolve that. But he was warmer to be around. And that was a lovely moment. I'm not sure how much we'll do together, but it's a good thing that there's some tenderness that we feel. It's a big deal because making boundaries with families is so forbidden. And it's not right for everyone. Some people should not do that because that's not their path. Some people need to do that by saying, I won't show up at this time, or I'm only going to be there for 2 hours and I have to go, or I'm not going to do the Christmas thing because it's so painful. And some people need to say goodbye forever. There's no right answer to that, but it's forbidden. We need a culture that says, following your own path. And if that means saying no forever or no for a year, or this is the boundary that I'm going to create, we need a culture that doesn't witness that as being, what's wrong with you? Why are you so unfriendly? Blood is thicker than all this. We need a culture that says, that's an okay path.
Yeah, you do you.
You do you.
Yes. Yeah. Do you feel like, because for me personally, I feel like some of the grieving will have to wait until my parents have passed. And I'm curious that once your parents passed, do you feel like there was an additional layer of healing or grieving that you were able to do while they were alive?
It's an amazing question. Yes. And it makes me think of so many people. I think Virginia Woolf comes up in my mind because she said she couldn't write certain things until her literal father died. She's a pretty amazing, awake, I don't know what they call it, powerful, articulate woman. When my mother literally died, and I thought I knew what I needed to know about her and the story, and when my mother literally died, certain doors opened up in me. And one of those doors was more openness to being intentionally mothered by my wife at times. Oh, your wife needs to mother your grown man. Sometimes, yeah. Sometimes I'm a little kid who needs her just to hold me. That's not my whole story. I have other capacities.
That's not my only trick in my book.
No, my only trick, I'm not like, I need the women to mother me all the time. But sometimes I do. Sometimes I need men to mother me. My connection with the earth as a kind of mothering experience, something holds me in a safe way, not meaning I can't get injured by people, not that kind of safety, but some kind of spiritual safety in a way. I became more open to that. I started growing into that, but something made open more to getting this thing called mothering. I don't mean, again, little child who is hurt, who needs to be held, but something that's there that holds me in a way. I feel more of that, and that allows me to let go of the human being that this Louise Bedrick woman was. She couldn't feel that. There's an incredible poet, Jewish poet. By the way, today's Rosh Hashanah, the first day of the Jewish New Year, and David Ignatow, and he tells, there's a poem called Kaddish, which means the Jewish prayer for the dead, and he tells this poem upon his mother's deathbed. And she's dying, and he's saying, I'm watching her die in the hospital. And at the end of the poem, I'm not going to get the words right, so sorry, David Ignatow, who's now gone. But it says more or less, the earth was your mother. He's talking to his mother, as you were mine. Now I whisper to the rock and stone, mother, I found you. Whisper to the earth, mother, I love you, and I am safe. He says, and I always have been. Now, he doesn't mean safe from people violating you. People could hurt you, wound you, kill you, mistreat you. But I took those words and I understood something in the last years of my life about the safety he was talking about. There's something that holds us. And that's dangerous to say to people who haven't owned their own violence. Oh, I'm really safe. No, my father really did violated me and injured me and et cetera. But this turning to the earth, mother, I found you, whisper to the rock and stone, I love you. Somehow I understood that connection with other forms of being mothered, that when the literal mother was gone, my psyche opened up to more. Thanks for asking that. I haven't talked about that enough, or almost ever.
Beautiful. So what did you want to put in this book that you didn't think was already out there about shame?
I think because there's something that I know I want to say. First, this shame is not only a feeling. Most people don't know that shame is operating. That's why I talk about these stories of people saying, I have a forgiveness problem, I have an anger problem, I have a procrastination problem, I have a cigarette smoking problem. Shame is operating there, but people are not identifying shame. And the second thing is, most of the ideas about shame is that we need more love and self-acceptance and things like that. You can literally unshame. Shame does something. It hides things from yourselves, and it turns things in you into pathologies, things to fix. You can literally unshame, and I have a method for doing that that's very clear and straightforward. I indicated that by talking about the smoker, for instance. And that is, you do the opposite of what's wrong with you. You need to fix that. That's screwed up. Let me help you cure yourself of that problem. That unshaming says the thing that you're thinking is a problem has intelligence living in it. And that if we look at it as beautiful, intelligent, powerful, and nourish the seed of it, not don't put more needles in your arm, but if we get to know what that experience is that you're getting from the putting the needle in your arm, you'll find things about yourself that are very important to you. And we can locate those, and you can make contact with those, and then you literally unshame. You take something that was hidden and looked at as a pathology and turn it into your gifts and your intelligence. There's nothing out there that has that process of unshaming until I offer this. I think I shouldn't be saying that, like, David, you're bragging about that. I'm really not. I spent 38 years studying that, and I do know this is true. You can, you know, and I teach people how to do that.
Yeah, I was looking on your website, and I love what you say. Let's see, this is like your claims to fame, what you say. Can you say this off the top of your head? Do you have it memorized? Like, what I once saw? Can you say that off? Have you memorized what you wrote?
No. What does it say? I don't know.
I thought maybe this would be your tagline that you just memorized. You said, what I once saw as insecurity, I now see as a capacity to be more vulnerable and acutely aware of my needs for more fluid boundaries. What I once saw as anger, I now see as a fire of passion and intensity that carves a path for my voice to be more empowered and free. What I once saw as resentment in my relationships, I now see as deeper needs and desires that are needing expression and support. What I once saw as criticalness and judgment, I now see as an impulse to develop finer theories and methods for understanding the human condition as well as the urge to write and communicate those theories. What I once saw as flaws, errors, and derailments, I now see as the spirit of my own intelligence guiding me toward a more authentic life.
Wow. Who wrote that?
Some dude.
I'm laughing. I know I did.
Some dude.
Here's some dude. I don't know.
Rando.
Right. Not the shy part, right? Yeah. The terrorized part. Thank you for remembering.
Anything to add to that? Anything come to mind when I read that to you?
I mean, yeah. I mean, one of the things that's been on my mind in the last couple of years is aging. And the shame around aging, what I once saw as my body becoming more frail, my hair falling out, which it is, my becoming more wrinkled, or becoming more fragile in a way. Like I hurt my arm and it takes a lot longer for it to repair. My prostate is growing. That means my urine doesn't flow as easily. And there's 10 zillion supplements. If I mean, you know how it is, you say something online, I have a whatever. Yeah. A left eye twitch problem, and yeah. They're going to get 10 zillion am, and so I get prostate.
You just think it in your head, and you get a million am.
And then writer's like, how do I get like 10 zillion messages?
Out loud.
I can't look without getting these things. Mm-hmm. I think what I once saw as the difficulties of aging, I now see as the grace of not being able to bully myself quite as much. Mm. My system can't be forced into an expression that's not only good for me. I could, when I was 30, if it pushed me, I can go on the door. And that's not only bad as a 30-year-old. At least it wasn't only for me. Then good, push yourself harder. But now I can't quite bully myself this more. And when I bully myself less, I take more time for reading poems and being more vulnerable with other people. I tell my students more about the mistakes that I make when I teach them, and not only about the great things that I've done and the great examples. So aging has, you know, I no longer see it only as that negative thing that the culture does. How do you stop aging? How do we get over this? Well, that's good. Be healthy and all that stuff and take supplements and that's good. But then the complicitness in the shame of aging, is there anything there that's also good in aging? Yeah, it can be anyway.
Well, this has been amazing.
Amazing.
The book is great. I can't wait to finish reading it. It'll be in the show notes. What else do you want to plug? Anything else?
My last book is called You Can't Judge a Body by Its Cover, which is about body shame and sexism. And that was written a few years ago. That's gotten great reviews. Talking about trauma, Gabor Amate just wrote an endorsement of the Unshaming Way, the book that's coming out.
Amazing. Congratulations.
Talking about. So I'm proud of
that. Not congratulations on the book, just congratulations on the endorsement.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I know. A little kid in me is going, yeehaw, yeah.
If it's going to write you like a congratulations note, it's just going to be on the endorsement.
Good. And I teach lots of classes, like from facilitators who want to learn how to do
I got lots of therapists and practitioners that listen to the podcast. So.
Oh, great. Yeah. So they can find out, or they could take free things or short classes. They can learn about all kinds of different things. So there's all kinds of teaching that I do. Well, follow me on Instagram and just learn without any cost. That they can study my reels and all kinds of. I do something called Unshamed TV, and I think it's like 20 episodes of that. And I just work with people I've never met live Instagram. And
then, how does that work? You just pick a rando?
People volunteer.
That's cool.
Because they know about me. They tell a person, the producer of my show, who vets them to make sure they know that they're not going to get ongoing therapy and that they can do what we're about to do. And then I come on, I don't learn about them. I don't learn anything before the session. And I spend like 40 minutes to an hour with them. And that's an unshaming with them. And just, it's live. I don't know what's going to happen. Maybe they're going to hate my guts. Maybe they're going to love it. Maybe they're going to flirt with me.
It's reality TV.
It's totally real, but it's real. And that's the point of it. And then I do my unshaming way. People can watch and see what it looks like. Yeah.
I love that. Well, thank you so much for your time. This has been awesome. This has been fun.
Thank you so much. Your energy and the playfulness and the zippy zappy and
the world
that you ask personal questions of me, it brings me out in ways that some people wouldn't bring out. That's also
good. I only want to get personal here.
I know it.
That's why people come here. Yeah. Don't let it all go.